Too loud, about right? Okay. It's always kind of dangerous to put a mic in front of me for a lot of reasons. But one is I learned to make myself heard around the dinner table over the din of 10 kids. So, I mean, I really don't need a mic. But, you know, when in Rome, as we say. Well, thank you so much for being part of this brief presentation on evolution and the pro-life cause. And it's quite obvious that Lutherans for Life understands that there is a very deep connection between evolution and the abortion revolution. And there is a deep connection, and I'm going to begin just by making some comments about that connection before going to the data. And let me clarify, by way of preliminaries, a couple of things. One is that whenever I speak on anything, usually within 5 minutes, I have people getting their pens out and looking for something to write on, because what I give is information. I'm more of a reporter than a speaker. I report on information. My life is one of research and reporting. And you can do that if you want, but on one of the tables out in the lobby, is one of my recent books. It's called 10 Truths About Evolution That Everyone Should Know. And everything I'm going to say this morning is in that book, times 10. And so if you want to take notes, fine, but if you want to save yourself the trouble, buy the book. And I just want you to know that $10 is my cost. And so I'm not here as a money grubber. I'm not saying I'm not a money grubber, but I'm not here for that reason. So anyway, think about picking that up. I'll warn you, it's written at the high school level, because I wanted to put something together that high school students could read easily. And I know some churches use it in Bible classes, and it's intended for that. It's not intended for the great scholars of the world. It's intended for everybody. So the connection between evolution and the pro-life cause, and let's start with creation and the pro-life cause. If you've read Genesis 1:1, I'm sure you all have, you have read this: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And that's a very, very simple one-liner that tells us where everything came from, including life. And then we read in Genesis chapter 2, when God created human beings, he did so, Moses said, in his image. In fact, in Genesis chapter 2, Moses says, God created us in his image 4 times. Do you think there's a little bit of emphasis there? Absolutely. This is absolutely fundamental to understanding the universe, the world, and all of life. Absolutely fundamental. And then when we get to Genesis chapter 9 and read about God's instructions to Noah after the flood, God says that Noah and his descendants can have the animals for food and so on, but that they may not take the life of a human being. Not talking about justice, we're talking about murder. Why? Because human beings are made in God's image. And so understanding the image of God, that we're made in God's image to be like him. And if you ever want to get me back at another Lutherans for Life conference and give you an hour lecture on what it means to be made in the image of God, I will do it. But that'll have to wait for another time. It's just extraordinary, all right? What we are is absolutely amazing. So if people don't recognize we're made in God's image, obviously there is far less of a reason to protect human life. So let's consider, I mean, in fact, where people end up who don't recognize that, but let's do so from the perspective of where people are coming from in our country. Gallup, 3 years ago, did a survey on where people stood on the evolution versus creation. This is what Gallup found. And again, I'm here as a reporter. There might be a couple times when I might give you my opinion, but when I do, I'm going to say, and by the way, this is my opinion. Otherwise, I'm just going to report information. And like I say, I'm a researcher, and the information speaks for itself. Well, this is what Gallup found. He found that 46% of the public believes that God created the world in pretty much the same form as it is today, and did so within the last 10,000 years or so, so almost half. And we'll simply say this is the typical creationist position. He also found that 32% of the public believes in theistic evolution. And this is kind of your in-between. You, if you want to be an evolutionist and a creationist at the same time, okay, then you believe in theistic evolution. God used evolution to create. And Gallup found that 15% of Americans believe in materialistic or atheistic evolution, which is what Darwinism is. So that's where the public is from, and that's coming from, and that's what we are dealing with. Now, unfortunately, the theistic evolution, many of these people, including the creationists, don't fully realize that we are continually being misled about the evidence for evolution. And this is what I'm going to focus on primarily this morning, how the American public is being systematically misled about the evidence for evolution, and that's what my book deals with as well. So, but let's look at what some of the people from these different points of view say. Peter Singer, ethicist from Princeton, says, by the way, I had a little debate with Peter Singer a couple years ago at Mankato State University, or Mankato, Mankato State, we say. Anyway, Peter Singer says, a healthy dog has more of a right to life than a person with a disability. And when he was speaking at MSU, there were a number of people with disabilities who came to protest, and rightly so. And this is true wherever he goes, because this is a pretty awful position, that a healthy dog has more of a right to life than a person. But coming from his worldview, it is a consistent conclusion. Okay, I mean, if that's where you're starting from, this is where you should end up. And so you can't criticize them for not being consistent on this. You can't on other things. By the way, Singer says if you prefer human life over animal life, you are guilty of what he calls speciesism. Okay? That's Peter Singer. Richard Dawkins, clearly the most famous atheist turned agnostic in our country, author of The God Delusion, says, there's no right, there's no wrong. All we have is DNA, and we dance to it. Okay? Totally consistent with his point of view. Totally consistent. Now, I'm going to go off on a little bit of a side here, which I usually don't do, but I will at this time. Interestingly, a few months ago, in the face of the San Bernardino massacre, Peter Singer put out a tweet decrying what he called the religions of violence. Well, if there is no right and there is no wrong, what's wrong with violence? See, nobody can consistently live with that wacky worldview, and Peter and Dawkins is what. But anyway, this is where he should be, starting from his worldview. Dostoevsky, in his famous book, The Brothers Karamazov, has Ivan the Atheist, now this is not Dostoevsky's position, but he has Ivan the Atheist saying, if there is no God, then everything is permissible. And everything obviously includes abortion. So I'm not saying that every atheist supports legalized abortion, but I'm just saying if atheists are consistent with their position, they shouldn't have a problem with it, and they normally don't. But I don't want to say that everybody falls into these categories. It's not quite that simple. Okay, then we have the matter of theistic evolutionists. And I'm going to explain this by an example that is burned into my memory because I was a legislator from the St. Peter area in the Minnesota House and heard there a speech on the House given by a very prominent state rep who is also an economist at the University of Minnesota, a very highly respected man. I'm not going to mention any names, but some of you will know who he is. And I heard him argue that at the moment of conception in a human being, we have a single cell organism that is essentially the same as an amoeba. And then by the time we get to 8 weeks, we have a developing organism that's pretty much like a frog, okay, like an amphibian. And by the time we get to 12 weeks, we've progressed up to something like resembles a squirrel and so on. So what he was saying is that the human being retraces evolution in its embryonic and fetal development, all right? Very, very common position of evolutionists, and if you believe that, you have no problem with abortion, at least early abortion. And that is a very common point of view of theistic evolutionists. I'm not saying all of them believe that, but that you can see how people would easily come to that position. So what I want to do then is turn to the question, are these kinds of positions reasonable? Is this where the information leads us? And I'm going to make the case that these positions are not reasonable at all. What this representative in his argument about us being like an amoeba and a frog and a squirrel and so on was parroting was the views of an apologist, the primary apologist after Darwin's time, primary apologist for Charles Darwin, and that's Ernst Haeckel, as illustrated by Haeckel's drawings, which we know as Haeckel's embryos. And by the way, you can access this stuff on the net, just type in Haeckel's embryos and you'll get 25 different pictures like that. So the argument of Haeckel is that you look at the top row, and at the far left you have an embryo of a fish, far right you have an embryo of a human being, and in between you have a chicken and whatever. And so Haeckel's argument is that in embryonic development, all the organisms, all the species are basically the same. All right, that's the picture he's trying to make. They all look basically the same, they're all basically the same, and so an embryo, a chicken embryo, and a human embryo, and a fish embryo, all basically the same, and then they all develop, and at some point they become quite different, and in the far left, the fish embryo becomes a fish, and in the far right, the human embryo becomes a human being. So that's the theory. Biologists call this recapitulation, and it is the theory that every person here retraced the history of evolution in your own embryonic development. Okay? That is the theory. And you will find these embryos in many biology textbooks, high school and college today. And I want you to know there's a debate going on whether they're in the majority or not. And I'm not part of that debate. I just want to tell you for sure they're in many, perhaps the majority. Well, what's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with this picture? Well, there's a very prominent embryologist from the UK by the name of Richardson, who with others made an extensive study of what Ernst Haeckel said. And he and his associates concluded, these embryos don't look like that at all. It's not what they look like. The drawings are faked, okay? And to quote him, he says, and I quote, it looks like Haeckel's embryos are turning out to be one of the most famous fakes. I love it when people call a spade a spade. Don't give me any of this mumbo-jumbo, right? One of the most famous fakes in biology. There have been others, but this is one of the most famous. And so what Richardson did is he compared Haeckel's embryos, top row, to photographs of the same embryos, bottom row, and he says the embryos by photographs don't look the same at all. They're radically different. And so Haeckel says Richardson, obviously fake the drawings. And so this argument that the public has been bombarded with, and it's in many of the textbooks, is totally false. I mean, not half true, okay? Totally false. Nothing to it at all. But now let's give the evolutionists the extra mile, right? Let's give them the extra mile and let's say, well, you know, maybe the way they look doesn't matter that much. I mean, and by the way, there are any number of evolutionists who will say, yeah, Haeckel faked the drawings. But they still basically describe the essence of how people develop. Oh, really? Really? Well, Haeckel and Darwin and others of that time knew almost nothing about genetics. almost nothing about genetics, and let's keep in mind that when it comes to the development of any organism, genetics is everything. All right? Genetics is everything. We'll look at some of the detail on that. It's a photograph of a human ovum, enlarged quite a bit, in the potential process of fertilization by human sperm. Okay? I don't know if this is the process of fertilization or not, actually, because I think you know that once a sperm cell enters an ovum, the doors are shut and no other sperm can enter. And I don't know if this was the successful one or not, but anyway, certainly attempting, quite clearly. So when this happens, you have a recombination of the DNA from the mother with the father. And what you end up with is a fertilized ovum containing over 3 billion base pairs of genetic information in the DNA. All right? This is not my opinion. This is what we now know about the genome. Okay, how significant is this? Well, let me just mention this for starters. You know, we marvel at the DNA and the RNA, and we marvel at the genetic structure and so on. But keep in mind that the DNA only stores and transmits information. It's like a file cabinet. It's like the cabinet. It's not the information inside. The really amazing thing is the information that it carries. Because in that fertilized ovum is the genetic information to create a human being. That one single fertilized ovum. In every cell in your body, I don't care if it's a skin cell, if it's a hair cell, I don't care what it is. In every cell in your body is the genetic information to create you. And it is sometimes said that that genetic information is more extensive than what we have in all the libraries in the world. Do I know if that's true? I don't know if that's true. That's why I said it's often said. Let me just say, over 3 billion base pairs, it's a lot of information. Okay. So what's the real picture? In embryology, genetics is everything. You have there a baby boy, recently born. By the way, you know how you can tell it's a baby boy in this day and age? It's because the nurses decided to put a blue cap on it. They assigned it its sex at birth. That's what the left says. All right. Versus the chicken. At the moment of conception, that baby boy had the genetic information to be that particular baby boy, period. Nothing more, nothing less. And at the moment of conception, that little chick had the genetic information to be a chicken. Nothing more, nothing less. Okay? When does human life begin? Begins at conception. Period. No argument. This is not debatable. Okay? I mean, this is the way it is. And after conception, all it does is grow. And genetics, the genome, is everything. So even if they really look the same, who cares? Appearance means nothing. It's the genetics is everything. And so this notion that we retrace evolution in our embryonic development, ladies and gentlemen, is pure nonsense. And yet it's still in many biology books. Now again, I'm not giving you my opinion. This is what it is. There's no question about this. No question. So that's what we're dealing with. You know, the church has always had to deal with heresies. You know that? You know, in the first centuries of the early church, it had to deal with the Gnostic heresy, which is the denial of the incarnation. And we put together 3 ecumenical creeds to deal with various forms of the Gnostic heresy. The apostles, the Athanasian, and the Nicene. They all dealt with the heresies denying the incarnation. At the time of the Reformation, the church dealt with all kinds of heresies, as we know. And the Lutherans came out on the right side. What's changed? Nothing. We're in the same kind of situation today, except it's different heresies. And one of the biggest heresies we face today is Darwinism, and we need to deal with it aggressively. Okay, but having dispensed with Haeckel, let's look at some of the other evolutionary arguments. And to do that, I'm going to turn to the very famous debate between Bill Nye and Ken Ham. And the reason I'm going to go here is because it allows Bill Nye, speaking for the evolutionists, to define what he believes are the best arguments for evolution. I mean, I could take any of them and somebody could say, oh yeah, but you're just taking the easy ones. Oh no, okay. I'm going to take on the arguments that Bill Nye put forward because he obviously felt they were his strongest arguments, and I think it's likely that he would have received a lot of advice from other evolutionists with regards to how he should make his case, because it's a very, very public thing going into the debate. So we're going to look at Bill Nye's three arguments and see what they amount to. Here they are. Number one, Bill Nye said that the ice core dating on Greenland and Antarctica prove that the Earth is far older than what Genesis allows. All right. That was his first main argument. You see here a photograph of an ice core. And that is what this is, an actual photograph. This is what they look like. And again, I'm a reporter here. So what's with this conclusion that the ice cores prove that the Earth is 680,000 years old or more? What's with it? Well, first of all, we should notice, if you like to do math on a calculator, which is how I like to do it, if you do the math, you can ask the question, well, if these ice cores show the Earth is 680,000 years old, how many rings per inch do you need to have? Okay, you need to have about 14 per inch. Is that what you see? No. It's a lot closer to 14 per foot. All right? A lot closer, probably about 14 per foot. So let's correct their work and say, well, it looks like about 14 per foot, so this ballpark, let's say that's about what it is. Well, if that's what it is, we have to correct their date by a factor of 12. So it's not 680,000 years, it's about 50,000 years. So let's correct them that way. Then there's the assumption that every ring indicates a year, like on a tree. Can you tell the difference between a tree and ice? I don't think it's real tough, okay? Why should we assume that ice is like trees? I can see it now. Intelligence, word association on an intelligence test. Ice and trees. I don't think so. I happen to be one of these people who has several times been up on the top of a roof shoveling ice and snow off, you know, to try to prevent the building from caving in. And you know what? There's a ring indicating every precipitation event. You go up there, you're going to find 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 layers, all right? So the reality is you don't get a ring every year. I mean, does the ice start growing in the spring like a tree? It doesn't. I mean, in reality, you have a number of precipitation events per year. You know, if it's winter all year long, what do you have? Let's just say, let's guess a dozen, all right? So if it's really, the rings indicate a precipitation event, not a year, now what are you down to? Now you're down to about 4,000 years. And interestingly, you know, that's kind of a ballparkish figure. But let's dispense with the math and let's look at some hard facts. During World War II, there was a squadron of B-52s, P-38s, and a couple B-52 bombers that were abandoned on the Greenland ice cap. There was a storm, they couldn't go back, they were running out of fuel, so they landed on the ice. Well, it's tough to take off again when you're on the Greenland ice, and I don't know how you get fuel to them either. So the planes were abandoned. So in the late 1990s, there were a number of attempts to locate one of these planes and bring it up, and there is one that was located. It has the title of a Glacier Girl, but it took a number of years and a number of expeditions before one was found. It was finally found by the expedition known as the Greenland Expedition Society, And one of the reasons it was so tough to find is because the world of science advised the would-be rescuers the planes are 40 feet down at most, probably a lot less. But don't look for anything past 40 feet. Where were they actually found? 268 feet down. Okay, and here's an actual photograph. Again, I'm just a reporter. An actual photograph of the Glacier Girl, 268 feet down. There's the Glacier Girl restored to flying condition. Now it's in a museum someplace. 268 feet down. Okay, what does this mean? It means we know the actual rate of ice accumulation on Greenland. No assumptions, okay? No assumptions. It's just like if you have a rain gauge, you know, on your property. I mean, it tells you the truth. How much rain did you get? Well, gee, the gauge says 1.25 inches. You know. Is that your opinion? I mean, you're just reading the numbers. So we know the rate of ice accumulation in Greenland, period. This is not debatable. I would love to have Richard Dawkins come in here and say, Richard, we're going to debate on the rate of ice accumulation on Greenland. Do you think he would come in and debate that it's something other than what's indicated by the Glacier Girl? I mean, he'd be a fool to do that, because, I mean, this is hard fact. So now that we know the rate of ice accumulation of Greenland, we can easily calculate how long it would take a mile thick ice cap. You know what it is? It's about 1,000 years. Okay? And even if you allow for some compaction, which is reasonable, I mean, you're going to be well within the biblical time frame. I mean, sure. But here's an issue of what we actually know versus the conclusions based on false premises by the scientific community who, borrowing from last night, can't see the water because they live in it every day. I mean, honestly, they can't see the water when it's so obvious. But we know the actual rate of ice accumulation, and so we're going to conclude that Nye's argument about the ice core in Greenland is totally false. But then he said Antarctica, too. Well, keep in mind, the ice cores in Antarctica, guess what? They look just the same as the ice cores in Greenland. And guess what? It's exactly the same assumptions, though. All right? So how much confidence are we going to have in the ice cores on Antarctica? Al Gore, notwithstanding. All right? Well, apart from we know the whole system is fallacious, we have historical documents that tell us a lot. By the way, I'm going to go back here for a second because I forgot to put in my plug for Norwegians. Being a Norske, you know, I mean, go Vikings. I have to put in a plug for Norwegians. We know that the Norwegians had two settlements on Greenland 1,000 years ago. I mean, this is just documented history. One was a fishing settlement, one was a farming settlement. Why did they have a farming settlement? Because it was green grass as far as the eye could see. We know that Leif Erikson discovered America. Yes, Vikings. All right, about 1,000 years ago. I mean, is there any doubt about this? No. There have been two sites excavated in Newfoundland. Clearly, Viking, I mean, they even found lutefisk. There's no question. These were Viking settlements. I mean, seriously, they found all kinds of Norwegian artifacts there. No doubt about it. By the way, the way they found it is they went back to some of the early Viking records that the world of science had always said, oh, you can't believe them. Oh, yeah? A couple of people said, well, let's see where they take us. They took the people to these settlements in Newfoundland. That's how they found them. By the records. Gee, maybe records are worth something. How could Leif Erikson sail from Greenland to Newfoundland, I mean, from Norway to Greenland? He didn't. He told us that he sailed from Greenland, not from Norway. You sail from Greenland to Newfoundland, guess what? It's about a third as far. And you've got different islands that you can do a hop, skip, and a jump. Then he called Newfoundland what? He called it Vinland. Why would he call it Vinland? Because there were grapevines. Are there grapevines there now? No. Why? It's too cold. So 1200 AD, 1300, it started getting cold. By 1500, it was so cold, both the settlements were gone. Why? Because the earth got a lot colder. But anyway, 1,000 years ago, the earth was much warmer than it is today. Greenland was much warmer. By the way, if you want me to go into this later, I will. The sea level was 25 feet higher 1,000 years ago. Why? Because there wasn't much ice in Greenland and Antarctica. Okay, I got my plug in for the Vikings. Now I can go back to Antarctica. And I'll put my plug in for the French. In 1531, a very well-known mathematician from France called Orontius Phineus, extremely well-known scholar of history. He was the head of the mathematics department at Collège de France, College of France, wrote numerous books, textbooks. One of the things he did was he drew maps based on source maps. He drew this map of Antarctica. And this is only half of the map. You see in the Latin there, see in the Latin, if you can see it, Orbis Descripto, description of the globe in Latin. This is the map from the perspective of the South Pole, from the perspective of Antarctica. And if we had a lot of time, we'd look at it from the perspective of the North Pole, too. But this is from the perspective of Antarctica. What do you see there? Okay? You see in the lower right, South America. You see in the lower left, a little ways up, Africa. You can see Madagascar. And on the upper left, you see Australia. What is this? This is Antarctica that supposedly was discovered in the 1800s. Orontius Phineus drew a map of it in 1531. This map of Antarctica is so accurate that modern cartographers, map makers, are mystified as to how it could be this accurate. It just blows them away. We can't explain this, they say. And interestingly, you can see the bays on Antarctica, especially on the upper side to the right. We didn't know those bays were there until the early 1950s when sonograms were used to discover where there was water underneath and where there was land underneath. Okay? So we didn't know those were accurate until we did sonograms. But the map with the actual land mass and this and the Phineas map, the match is incredible. I mean, it's clearly the same continent without much ice on it. Now, we don't know how far the source maps so go back. Another map maker, a Turk, very skilled map maker, said his source maps go back to the time of Alexander, went back to the time of Alexander the Great, 325 BC. And Orontius Phineus' source maps probably went back that far or farther. Who mapped it? Phoenicians? Perhaps, we don't know, but somebody did. And what this means is that Antarctica was largely ice-free sometime within the last several thousand years. How far back can you push it? I don't know. 3,000 maybe, 4,000 maybe, we don't know. But it's certainly not millions. It's not 680,000, right? So, what does this mean? We have historical records, by the way. There are probably four or so other ancient maps that show Antarctica largely ice-free. Pyrrhus map is another one, okay? But there are others, too. One of them, the Boucher map, shows Antarctica divided into two land masses. And we didn't know that until the 1850s either, from the sonograms, okay? Clearly, with a minimum of ice on it, what does this mean? It means the ice core dating method is simply so wrong as to be ridiculous. So we've got genuine historical records that demonstrate that the arguments are totally false, should not be taken seriously, this is not debatable, it's not a matter of opinion, it's just a matter of fact. Okay? Bill Nye's first argument against creationism is a total lie. Right? But again, bring Bill Nye, bring anybody in here. Let's debate the ice cores. I mean, they'd be a fool to do it because they're dead in the ice. It's cold, gets cold. What's the second argument? El Chico. Bill Nye said, by the way, how many of you have listened to or heard the debate? Quite a few. You can access it online really easily, and I would recommend it. You know, it's free. Access it online and there's the whole debate. Here's Nye's second argument. He says Old Chico, which is a Norway spruce tree and a sort of mountaintop high area in Sweden, is 9,550 years old, and that proves that the world is older than the Bible allows. That's his second argument. Now, let me say, first of all, even if the tree was that old, which it's not, that really is not a problem for a creationist position. And here, let me quote John Brugge, Wisconsin Synod, not your far-left church body. Professor in the seminary there says, within Genesis, you can easily date the earth between 6 and 12,000 years. John Brugge's opinion, I'm not going to get into that. Others push it back somewhat farther. But anyway, 9,550 really is not an issue. But let's assume it is. Because Bill Nye used that, and what do we make of it? Well, this is the tree named Old Chico. The person that discovered it named it after his dead dog, Chico. That's why it's called Old Chico. See, it's so easy to remember these things. I want to talk to the students here, too. It's so easy to remember these things when you remember what you remember them by. So just remember the tree is named after the dog, Chico. And you see, it just so happens that I have some Norway spruce trees on my property down by St. Peter. I call them young Chicos. Same tree. Okay, same tree. And if you want to come and visit us, we're 8 miles northwest of St. Peter. Drive to right by our driveway and say, hey, hi, young Chicos, and come driving up. Well, anyway, about 50 years ago, one of these trees died, and so, of course, I cut it down. I sawed it up, probably, I had a wood furnace in my house, probably heated the house with it, but I don't remember that, but I remember cutting it down, and a stump was left in the ground. And so when I started looking at this, I thought, you know what? I have a hunch that if I put a chain, draped a chain over that stump, hooked it onto a tractor, been in the ground 50 years, I have a hunch there's not enough root structure left there to hold a tree if I tug it. So I put my trusty John Deere tractor, backed it up to it, draped a chain over it, gave it a tug, guess what? Rolled right out. Rolled right out of the ground. No problem. Why? The roots had rotted away. Why do I mention that? Because Nye says this in the debate, this tree is 9,550 years. See, we are much too trusting. And we think, oh, they must have counted the tree rings. Uh-uh. Guess again. By the way, National Geographic says Old Chico is 400 years old at most. Oh, really? Really? So what's going on? Well, the theory is that the roots stay alive, okay? And when one tree dies, the roots send up new shoots. And it's the roots that are 9,550 years old. Well, why didn't I say that? He said the tree. He didn't say the roots. But that's the theory. Okay, how do you know that? Well, the only way you know that, and this is the way it's argued, well, carbon-14 dating of the roots demonstrated that the roots are 9,550 years old. Oh, really? See a problem with that? Well, one big problem is that carbon dating begins after something dies, all right? And I searched high and low to see if there's anybody in the scientific community who said something different, that carbon dating can begin before something dies. No, they all agree. The carbon clock begins when something dies. So what they have to be saying is the roots have been in the ground 9,550 years. That's why I pulled out the stump. So you're telling me the roots have been there for 9,550 years and haven't rotted away? I don't think so. What are we talking about, ladies and gentlemen? We're talking about total fraud. Okay, it's just like Haeckel's embryos. It's just like the enemies of Jesus that came with all these lies. This is a total lie. Nothing to it at all. Total lie. Okay? Total lie. By the way, they're talking about putting a chain link fence now around the tree so nobody can come and see it. You can only get within 100 feet. Really? Let's look at his next argument. This is the big one of evolutionists. Okay, this is the biggie. They all use it. I think they all use it, but there's the big argument. Nye's third argument is that the fossil record demonstrates that the earth is far too old for Genesis. That's the big kahuna, the big argument, all right? So this is what Geographic said, and this was, I used Geographic because 9 was not real clear. And so I thought, well, I want to state it clearly, so I'm going to the National Geographic. This is what Geographic said. They say humans have walked the earth for 190,000 years. By the way, this date is like putty. It changes all the time, right? All the time. Now some people say a million. Well, that's a pretty big difference from 190,000 and a million. And what's with this precise dating? All right. A mere blip in Earth's 4.5 billion year history. A lot has happened in that time, okay? And 64 million years after dinosaurs went extinct, modern humans emerged in the Cenozoic era. 64 million years between human beings and dinosaurs, okay? Let's test that. Let's test that because this is right at the center of the fossil record argument. See, the fossil record is commonly pictured like this, okay? Humans just kind of line, small line at the very top. Dinosaurs, very, very prominent place, supposedly that went extinct 65 million years ago. That's the typical description. Well, let's see if that is accurate. And I'm going to ask the question, what if, students, what if it could be shown that dinosaurs and humans lived at the same time? What's left of this nice picture? It's gone. I mean, what if humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time? Then the whole thing falls flat, right? Obvious, okay? Let's look at that. Here is a photograph of a Mesopotamian cylinder. A cylinder is a metal device used to make an official record. They usually were records of military conquests, but the official records. And on this Mesopotamian cylinder, on the left, you see creatures that resemble the modern sketch on the right of a sauropod, Apatosaurus, one of the large dinosaurs, right? I would invite you to put this to the test. If you care to pay $10 for my book, you'll have a picture of this. Take it to a second grader and just show the second grader the image on the left and ask the second grader, what is that? What do you think they're going to say? They're not going to think twice. They're going to say dinosaurs. You dummy. That's what they're going to say. And they know what it is. Well, how did the artists 5,000 plus years ago know what the dinosaurs looked like? I assure you, they did not have museums with reconstructed dinosaur bones. Or if they did, we haven't found in all the archaeology, we haven't found any, okay, no museums of reconstructed dinosaur bones. How did they know what they looked like? If they've been extinct, you know, 64 million years, that's a long time. You might think I'm old. I'm not that old. Age is relative, all right? Let's look at another photograph. This is a photograph of a sculpture, a head of a dinosaur, and it's in a museum in Cairo. Very, very interesting. One horn, okay? Could this be the unicorn that is written about in ancient literature numerous times? And there are those who say, well, we know the Bible isn't true because it mentions unicorns, and everybody knows unicorns don't exist. Oh, really? I've heard that argument 100 times. Sodom and Gomorrah don't exist either, you know. Could be the unicorn. A sculpture. Here's another one. This is a slate palette, and it comes from Hierakonpolis, Upper Egypt. And if you can see the creatures in the middle, this slate palette is intended to describe the majesty, the strength of King Narmer and how he united Egypt. And on the back side is pictured him subjugating his enemies. And on this slave palette, you see the enemies being marched, the slaves, captives being marched on the top. You see a picture of a bull on the bottom. Why the dinosaur? Strength. Okay, clearly dinosaurs. Again, ask any second grader. Interestingly, the dinosaurs are very commonly pictured with their necks intertwined like this. And I'm sure there's a reason. They must have seen them like this. But anyway, very commonly pictured that way. Here's another one. This is especially interesting because it's a mosaic. A Roman mosaic goes back less than 2,000 years. You know, when you do a mosaic, you have to do very careful planning. You don't just go up someplace and, I'm just going to draw something, right? Mosaic, what are they? They're little ceramic tiles. Very careful planning goes into mosaics. What are they? Clearly, dinosaurs. By the way, notice on this and several of the other pictures we've looked at, there's something on top of the dinosaur's head, some cartilage maybe, like a chicken comb or something like that. Many of the ancient artworks show dinosaurs with cartilage on their head. Why don't we have this in the fossils? Because cartilage rots away. The only way we know that many dinosaurs had cartilage on the top of their head is from the artworks. This is genuine history, ladies and gentlemen. These are artifacts, historical artifacts. This is genuine history. This is not speculation. This is not my opinion, genuine history. Let's take another one. On a temple in Cambodia, discovered just a few years ago, the temple goes back to about 1200 AD, fairly recent. There is a relief carved in stone of what obviously is a stegosaur. See those big fins on its back? There's a stegosaur skeleton. It's the only creature that had these kind of fins on its back. Only one. The creatures that are reliefs, there's carved in stone, are all creatures that were common to people of that time. Monkeys, swans, some kind of big cat. I mean, none of this is speculation. These are all the creatures people were familiar with. So how would the artists have known what a stegosaur looked like unless they had seen it or had access to records, written, or other artworks? I mean, come on. How would they have known this? They wouldn't have. I find that every once in a while I like to look and see how the evolutionists explain this. I want to give you two common explanations of this stegosaur. Number one, just because it looks like a dinosaur, that doesn't mean it is a dinosaur. Really? I'm one of these believers, you know, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Give me a break. Is that science? Another is this. Well, I think what that is, I think it's a big pig, and I think the artist just stuck these big leaves on its back just for effect. Oh, really? Is that believable? I don't think so. Let's look at another one. Arizona, Lake Havasupai Canyon, clearly dinosaur. Okay, how far back this goes, we don't know, but it's centuries. It goes back a long, long time. Painted by the natives. Plesiosaur, being brought home by a hunter. The Mayan figurine from the Mayan culture in South America. So they ate them. Here's a plesiosaur in sight. I have to say, I had to wait a long time to get this photograph. They're hard to find. Hard to find these days. Ceramic cup from Bolivia. Dinosaurs fighting. This stone was uncovered in Colorado by individuals that were building a garage. And they were excavating to lay the foundation for the garage. And this thing popped up. And this photograph is from a local newspaper. That's why it's so grainy. Okay, it's a newspaper photograph. Clearly, dinosaurs being pictured in Colorado. The Ishtar Gate at Babylon, row after row of three creatures, bulls, lions, and dinosaurs. They're kind of stick man type creatures, but obviously a dinosaur. Look at the tongue, look at the cartilage on the top of its head. Look at the coloration. We assumed today the dinosaurs were drab, like light green or dark gray. Do we know that? No. This strongly suggests that some of them were very colorful. Why not? I mean, snakes are colorful. I don't like snakes, but that's another matter. A ceramic from Acambiro, Mexico. I better truck along here. From a cave in Peru, ceramic. This one is very interesting because this was very recently discovered in Kuwait, in a cave in Kuwait. Hunters, and I'm going to tell you how the paleontologist who was signed by the Kuwaiti government describes this, and I quote, "These prehistoric pictograms seem to illustrate dinosaurs being hunted by humans. adds Mr. Al, better look at it closely, Shalafi. This is a revolutionary new perspective, and it will certainly be hard for many historians and anthropologists to accept. Yeah? What does it show? It shows that people and dinosaurs lived at the same time. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, there are at least 50 of these artworks. At least 50. Drawings, reliefs, sculptures, ceramics, everything that clearly depict dinosaurs. Clearly, no question. What does that tell you? It tells you that dinosaurs and people lived at the same time. We also, and before I go to the written records, the evolutionists even now are admitting that dinosaur bones are being found that contain soft tissue. And the evolutionists have insisted for years that soft tissue could only exist a couple thousand years. Right? They're finding blood cells, soft tissue, in the dinosaurs. And it's fairly recent that they've admitted that this is real. Does that change their mind? No, there must be some explanation that we just don't know what it is, but there has to be some explanation, all right? It reminds me of the old story of the psychologist who was treating a man who believed he was dead. And to try to reach this man and convince him he was alive, he took him into a mortuary and he rolled a number of dead bodies out of the refrigeration. And he took out a pin and stuck the corpse in the arm and said, look, it doesn't bleed. Took out another body, stuck it with a pin. Look, no blood. Took out another cadaver, stuck it with a pin. Look, no blood. And then he grabbed the arm of a patient, stuck it with the pin. Big, dark, rich bubble of blood. How do you think the patient responded? My stars! Dead people bleed after all. That's just the kind of, I mean, that is what we're seeing. Now, apart from what we've looked at so far, we have written records of dinosaurs. Apart from all the artwork, Job chapter 40 is clearly a large sauropod. Patasaurus, or one of those, clearly a large sauropod. Let's just read a little bit of it. Look at Behemoth, which I made along with you, and which feeds on grass like an ox, so it's a herbivore. What strength it has in its loins, what power in the muscles of its belly. Its tail sways like a cedar. The sinews of its thighs are close-knit. Its bones are tubes of bronze. Its limbs like rods of iron. It ranks first among the works of God. The biggest land animal. What is it? Clearly dinosaur. Only one. There is no other creature that even comes close. By the way, Behemoth is Hebrew for megabeast. That's what the Hebrew literally means, a megabeast. What is it? Clearly a dinosaur. Clearly a written record of a dinosaur. And here I'm going to give you my opinion. My opinion is the translators should translate Job chapter 40, dinosaur, because that's what it is. I mean, why use the Hebrew when we know what it is? I mean, are you going to translate this or aren't you? Okay, get courage, translators. Okay, get some spine to you. You know what this is. It's a dinosaur. That was my opinion. Job chapter 41 is also of great interest to us. The Leviathan. All right? Leviathan. What is it? We don't have time to look at the whole chapter. We're just going to look at a few verses. Who dares open the doors of its mouth, ringed about with fearsome teeth? Its back has rows of shields. Notice this. Tightly sealed together, each is so close to the next that no air can pass between. They are joined fast to one another. They cling together and cannot be parted. Shields, what are these shields? Well, its undersides are jagged potsherds, leaving a trail in the mud like a threshing sledge. It makes the depths churn like a boiling cauldron. So what? It's at home on the land, and it's at home in the water. All right? It has shields on its back that are so tightly close, joined together, no air can pass between. Nothing on earth is its equal. Look, take that literally now. Take that literally. Nothing on earth is its equal. What is that? A creature without fear. It looks down on all that are haughty. It is king over all that are proud. Okay? What is it? Clearly, Sarcosuchus imperator, supercrop. clue. It is a perfect description of Super Croc. Here I want to tell you a 20-second little story. I was a student in a seminary and had the assignment in a Hebrew exegesis class to interpret Job chapter 40 and Job chapter 41. And Job chapter 40, that was easy. I mean, clearly a dinosaur. Job chapter 41, I have no idea what this is. That's what I had to say to the prof. Then, in the late 90s, Super Croc was discovered. I tell you, I was on cloud nine for 2 weeks. Because finally we knew what the creature was in Job chapter 41. Clearly, Super Croc. This is the skull of Super Croc compared to a normal crocodile, okay? Super Croc was a lot like a crocodile today, except, guess what? It was 10 times bigger. And it had armor on its back. Job said no air can pass between. It also said you can't penetrate it with a spear, you can't penetrate it with an arrow. Why? These are bony shields, and they overlap like siding on a house. You could not put a spear or an arrow through. In a fight, let's say, with T-Rex, the teeth of T-Rex would not penetrate into Super Croc. Now notice in this artistic work here, you have Super Croc going after what? T-Rex. What kind of a match would this be? A big T-Rex weighed in at 6 tons. Super Croc, 10 tons, almost twice as big, all right? Super Croc had armor, body armor. T-Rex had none. Super Croc had a bite twice as strong as T-Rex. Super Croc could grab a critter and drag it into the water and drown it. T-Rex couldn't do that. Is this an even match? This is no contest, ladies and gentlemen. Job said, this creature is king. Scientific name, Sarcosuchus impurator. Impurator is Latin for king. Perfect description. There is no creature that comes close to the description of Leviathan in Job chapter 41. And I will state categorically, this is Super Croc. Sarcosuchus impurator. By the way, the Hebrew Leviathan means twisting one. Ever heard of the death roll of a crocodile? You know what it is. They grab onto something, I mean, that they're killing or killed, do a violent roll, and tear it to pieces. The crocodiles have the ability to lock the vertebrae in their necks so that they can do the death roll, and there's no give in the crocodile. So all of the power in the death roll is transmitted to their prey. Okay? One who twists. Is this one who twists? Yes. Is this king over everything? Absolutely. Is the lion the king of the jungle? Oh, no. Was T-Rex the king of the dinosaurs? Uh-uh. Super Croc was it. What's the problem? Evolutionists say Super Croc has been extinct for 100 million years, longer than the dinosaurs. I don't think so. So we've got the written record. Okay, I'm a person who believes in history. One of the usual criteria of the good historian is you let historical documents speak for themselves, unless there's compelling reason to the contrary. You let Job chapter 41 speak for itself, it just shouts, here's the king of all that God made in the animal kingdom, it's Super Croc. Okay, very, very quickly, and then we'll take time for a question or two. Where does this lead us? It leads us to the position that what the evolutionists say, and I've taken three of their arguments, it's what Nye apparently said was the strongest, there is nothing to any one of the three, zero. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. Get the book and I go into the other arguments. They're all fiction, they're all false in comparison to the King of Kings, the real King of Kings, Yeshua in the Hebrew, Jesus, the God-man, who said on the cross, it is finished. And that was the fulfillment of the promise made in Genesis. The seed of the woman would crush the head of the serpent. And it was also the fulfillment of what John said when he introduced Jesus to us, John the Baptizer. He said, remember, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. When Jesus said, it is finished, he said, the payment had been made. And by his resurrection, God declared that the sins of all people, even the abortionists, had been forgiven. And it is our glorious privilege to bring this message of truth, of real truth, true truth, and forgiveness to the world. Lutherans for Life, God bless you in what you do. It's not a matter of God being on your side. It's a matter of you being on God's side, and you are. Questions? You want to take a couple minutes for questions? I'm only 4 minutes over. Thank you. Question or comment? Yes, sir.
You say about laminin and the cross, the molecule, they understand they all, your DNA, every molecule, you look at it under a powerful microscope, you see the shape of the cross.
Really? I always like finding out things that I didn't know. Very good. Let me just use that as a springboard. CPH is publishing my new book on Christian apologetics in the fall of 17. And one of the things I have in there is a study of the Shroud of Turin, which is all indications are, and I'm just a reporter, all indications are, all the evidence suggests that the image on the shroud is a photograph of Jesus the moment he rose from the dead. Okay? Read about it. It's coming out. It's called Cutting Edge Christian Apologetics. Okay? Thank you.